email. You know, I just sent an email yesterday. Reasons was he was the previous Menahel of the Beis Din of America. For many years, President Menahel of the Beis Din of the CRC.
The Beis Din.
The Beis Din of the CRC okay. in Chicago. And has written extensively. It helps that that he graduated mm-hmm. Yale Law School. That helps to understand the inyanim of Beis Din and how they relate to our cause, such as secular courts. And there's a the Torah to not go to court, but to go to Bate Din. And obviously, in contemporary society, it's not so simple in some circumstances to go to Bate Din. And Rabbi Reis will clarify when one can go to, when one must go to Beis Din, when one may be able to go to courts or secular courts and use secular law. So, Muhammad Rab, thank you, Rabbi Reis.
Sure, okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Orlian. Always a privilege to be here. So there are two real, what I would call, bookends in the Torah that describe different facets of the requirement to utilize Beis Din. One is in Parshas Mishpatim, where the Torah says, Ve'elam Mishpatim asher tosim lifneihem. These are the ordinances that you're supposed to place in front of Lifnehem, in front of them. Lifnehem is a reference to Dayanim, to Dayani Yisrael, meaning Lifnehem, although Lifneakum, you're supposed to bring your court cases in front of the Beis Din, in front of Dayanim, and not in front of the non-Jewish courts, not in front of the secular courts. And then, towards the end of Chamishokom Sheitor in Parsha Shoftim, you have the other side of the equation, which is Shoftim Shotrim Titen Lecha B'chol She'arecha, that there's the affirmative, positive commandment to establish Batei Din. You should have rabbinical courts available for parties to be able to utilize. So you have the two different sides. One, the positive commandment to establish Batei Din rabbinical courts, and the other, that there is a prohibition of utilizing the secular courts rather than the Batei Din. Now, is this a mitzvah d'araisa? Is it a mitzvah d'rabbanon? Well, it appears to be a law b'ba miklal esse. It appears that there's a positive commandment, ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem, from which we derive, as Rashi writes, v'lo lifnei akum, it's the Gemara in Gittin, daf peiches amud beis, v'lo lifnei avodas kochavim. It appears to be an actual issa d'araisa. There are some who say that since if you look in the Sefer Achinuch, you look in the Rambam, in the standard Monei HaMitzvos, you don't find this articulated as a standalone mitzvah, then maybe this is only an asmachta, and therefore it's a din de rabbanon. However, the majority of poskim, I believe, come to the conclusion that, like the Tashbetz, for example, that this appears to be an issa d'araisa, and you have to figure out why, with respect to certain Isuri D'araisa, so they might not be officially listed in the Minyan HaMitzvos, but it appears to be a Torah prohibition. And at the very least, from the fact that it's derived from the Pasuk, I'd say that it's clear that on a meta-halachic level, it constitutes what we would call the Ratzon Hashem, as Rav Asher Weiss might put it, that this is the Ratzon Hashem. It's the clear desire of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we not utilize the secular court. So it is a clear usser, a clear isser in the cosmic system of halacha. What's the reason that one is not allowed to utilize the secular courts? Is it because we want to make sure that we give the Batei Din enough business to sustain themselves? No. We're happy if the Batei Din have no caseload whatsoever and everybody just settles all of their disputes amicably and peacefully, or that they don't have any disputes in the first place. So, but Beis Din is happy to be Yoshev Ubato. We have plenty of other things to do. We can sit and learn all day. Not a problem. So what's the reason then? So there are two different classical reasons that are given. One is found in Rashi HaMishpatim, Kedei Shel Yakir Elilim, so that you should not give glory to the idolatries, to other religions, so that somebody is Miyakir Hashem HaElilim, Lahashbicham, that it's almost as if you're giving them praise, that you're saying that their legal system is somehow more competent or more valuable to yourself than the system of Batei Din that is established by the Torah. And the second reason, which is found in the Rambam says that it's like somebody who's blaspheming and is lifting up their hand against the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, that it's a disrespect for the Torah's Moshe, and that is the second reason which is given. Now, the Tashbetz in his Atshuva, Chelek Aleph, Pesimen Kuf Tzadi Hei, points out that even though Rashi speaks about Elilim, he speaks about idolatries, nonetheless, the Isser is not restricted to secular courts that are affiliated with some sort of an idolatrous system. He mentions, for example, the Muslim courts. The worship of Muslim, of Islam, is a religion that believes in one God. So technically, it's not idol worship per se, but nonetheless, one is not allowed to utilize the Muslim courts either, because this is still showing respect to a system of law outside of that which is the Torah system of law. You can say that this is certainly understandable based on the reason given by the Rambam. The Rambam says that the problem is that you're meirim yad neged Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. You're lifting up your hand in rejection and repudiation of the Torah that was given through Moshe Rabbeinu. So whenever you do utilize a different legal system, even if it's not idolatry per se, it's still at the very least heirim yad b'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. So even if you have a country like in America where there is a separation between religion and state, and you'll say, oh, there's no idolatry that is being respected, that is being glorified by using the secular court system, nonetheless, you're still number one, miyakir, you're placing value upon a system other than Torah, and you are certainly being meirim yad v'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. There is a curious comment that appears in brackets in the Perish of the Klei Chemda on the Torah on Parshas Mishpatim, where he writes, well, of course, when we speak about this Issa, we're talking about the courts in Japan and China, where they worship actual idols and actual Buddhas and things of that sort. But it's not a sweeping prohibition that goes beyond that. I think that it's very clear that this is a comment that was thrown in for the censors. So whenever you see a weird comment of this sort that says, oh, of course, this only applies to, you know, foreign lands that nobody ever traveled to in those days, that it was something that was thrown in for censorship purposes. There's nobody who makes any such serious suggestion in any of the other Meforshim or classical works of Halakha. So I don't think that he subscribed to that notion either, but rather it is an absolute prohibition. Now, this is obviously a prohibition that relates to any kind of adjudication between one Jew and another Jew. It doesn't matter what the realm of adjudication is. It could be a monetary dispute over a landlord and a tenant. It could be over a dispute between two partners. It could be a real estate dispute. It could be a loan dispute. It could be a communal dispute. It could be a matrimonial dispute. It covers any kind of adjudication in the monetary realm between one Jew and another Jew, or in the personal realm. However, it does not necessarily cover matters which are in the criminal realm, because if you have a criminal case, like, let's say, for example, a case of child molestation, so that's not something which is automatically within the purview of Beis Din, because Beis Din doesn't have criminal authority unless they're officially given criminal authority by the government. In some European countries, the Batei Din of different towns were given that kind of autonomy by the government. If you live in a country where it's only the government that takes care of criminal law matters, criminal adjudication is not between one party and the other party. It's between the state. The state is the prosecuting party against the defendant who is accused of criminal behavior. When it comes to criminal adjudication, that generally is outside of the province of what we would call contemporary Beis Din authority. However, it is subject to a totally different line of discussion, which is called Mesira, which is called that you're not allowed to inform to the government upon another Jew. And the question is, what are the parameters of Mesira, of the prohibition of informing to the government nowadays? The Aruch HaShulchan has a discussion in which he says this only applies to a corrupt government, but not if you have a just government like where he lived in, you know, Lithuania, where he was assuming everything was, you know, kosher v'yosher. So if it was kosher v'yosher over there, it's probably kosher v'yosher over here. A just government means where the Jews are not specifically discriminated against. There's a system of laws which is sensible and which is orderly. If you hold like the Aruch HaShulchan, there might not even be an issue of giving over criminals nowadays to the authorities. But some say there's still an issue of a Shabbos Aveda. You don't just hand over a lost object, right? If somebody's looking for a criminal, so handing over the criminal is handing over a lost object. Let's say they're looking for tax evaders, and you know that your next door neighbor is a tax evader. There isn't any mitzvah, according to civil law, that you have to give over the tax evader to the government. So therefore, it might only be if somebody happens to be working in that. If a Hermann or Demalka, as the Gemara in Baba Metzia says, the working as a district attorney, so then it's their job to hand over criminals. So the Gemara has a discussion in which there were various Tanaim that disagreed with each other whether this was an admirable pursuit or not, but the Ritva indicates that it certainly wasn't a prohibited pursuit if you have a just system of laws for somebody to serve in that capacity. And obviously, even laws of Mesira are suspended when you have an individual like a child molester whose Meitzer is Sarabim, who's a public nuisance, who's causing tremendous trouble and grief for the community. So then it's certainly permissible and even appropriate to hand somebody over. So that's a different realm. That's in the criminal realm, where really what the focus would have to be is on the laws and the parameters of Mesira, but not on the laws and parameters of Arkos, at least not nowadays. And similarly, it has to be something which is a mishpah. We talk about elah mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, which means that it's a matter of adjudication. If you simply have a bureaucratic matter, like you have an uncontested will, and the uncontested will simply needs to be probated, but nobody's disputing the will, nobody is arguing over their share or portion of the inheritance with the other heirs, it's just a question of putting it to probate and making sure that the estate is divided according to the wishes of the decedent. So to take care of bureaucratic matters where you need the court system in order to free up assets or something of that sort, so that would be perfectly fine. Or similarly, if a couple is getting divorced, Rachmana Litzlan, and they already took care of all of their financial issues, either they worked it out themselves or they had the matter adjudicated in Beis Din, but now they need to receive the official document, which is called the civil divorce, so they're allowed to apply to court, as Rabbi Bleich writes, in order to receive the civil divorce document, because that's simply something bureaucratic. It's not subject to disputes between the parties. They already worked out all of their disputes. It's simply something that the Beis Din doesn't have the power to do. It's a governmental document, like picking up a driver's license or picking up a passport, where you have to just apply to the relevant authorities in order to receive the document. The Ksam Sofer in Choshen Mishpat Simen Gimel has a similar tshuva, in which somebody asked whether they could just record as a record, as a matter of record keeping in the secular court system, that a person before he died admitted that he owed money to a certain other individual. Let's say Reuben died and he admitted that he owed money in front of witnesses to Shimon. So can Shimon have the witnesses record in the secular court for record keeping purposes that this admission was made, so that when the yesomim of the person who died would become of age, and the individual Shimon who would want to enforce the obligation would want to bring it to Beis Din, he would have an official record that he would be able to marshal in order to collect the debt. So Ksam Sofer said, that's not an adjudication in court, that's just a matter of record keeping. Record keeping in court is not a problem. He said, that's not a mishpat, that's not a dispute adjudication, that would be permissible, that's not subject to what we mean when we speak about the Isser Arkos. Similarly, you have certain types of cases where it's simply a matter which is outside of the province of the Beis Din system, because of the fact that it is a matter that involves many individuals who are not Jewish and would not subject themselves to the Beis Din system. Like, for example, I have an individual who declares bankruptcy. So they declare bankruptcy. You can't really convene a bankruptcy order in a Beis Din. That requires bankruptcy court. Arguably, the person filing for bankruptcy is not an adversarial matter that would constitute a mishpat in the first instance, even though it has ramifications with respect to the amount that this individual now is going to owe or not owe their creditors going forward. But the filing for bankruptcy is not by itself considered to be a violation of the Isser of Arkos. Now, outside of these limited exceptions to the rule, any time that a person summons their fellow to a court as opposed to a Beis Din, they're committing an Isser Gomer. It's considered to be a very, very serious infraction, very serious violation, so much so that since we saw that Rashi calls it Mi'akiris Ha'alilim, which sounds like it's in the realm almost of Avodah Zarah, and the Rambam says, Yer Meirim Yad B'Toras Moshe Rabbeinu, that is treated very, very severely by the poskim. You may be familiar with the Mishnah Berurah's statement in a couple of places in his work, that if somebody actually brought another Jew to secular court, then they are disqualified from serving as a shliach tzibur for the Yomim Noraim, that it's considered to be such a shameful and such a hideous act that we can't have such a person representing the tzibur. They're not allowed to serve as a shliach tzibur. Now, this has many, many ramifications because of the severity of the Isser and the fact that there is an absolute prohibition. It's treated as a ritual prohibition. What do I mean by that? We have different sets of laws. We have ritual laws and we have monetary laws. When it comes to monetary laws, you can make conditions, right? A shoel is obligated to pay for, a borrower is obligated to pay for any damage, even if it occurs by accident on an object which is borrowed by the individual. But let's say I borrow an object and we want to stipulate I'm not going to be responsible for accidents. I'll only be responsible for Gneva Vaveda. So the Sugyan Baba Metzia Daf Tzadi Dalet says, we're allowed to do that. It's a monetary law, and in the realm of monetary laws, you're allowed to make conditions. We generally hold like Rabbi Yehuda, called Tanai Shebemamon Kayim. Any condition when it comes to monetary laws are binding. People can change the rules, so to speak. However, there's also the realm of Isser Veheter, ritual prohibition. What's an example of a ritual prohibition? I'm not allowed to do work on Shabbos. I'm not allowed to eat pig. These are laws that are in the ritual realm. I'm not allowed to charge interest on a loan that I make to you. Let's say that both the borrower and the lender say, that's okay, we forgive the law. We're going to overlook the prohibition and we'll agree that between the two of us we'll enter into an interest-bearing transaction. That's still a prohibition. You're not allowed to make a condition when it comes to a davashib isser, when it comes to something which is not a davashib mamon. It's not a monetary matter, it's an isser matter. It's a ritual prohibition matter. So therefore, the Ramban writes that this falls into that category. The Ramban in his commentary on the Chumash says that when it comes to the prohibition, lifnei hem below lifnei akum, that you're not allowed to use the secular courts, even if both parties would stipulate that they're okay with it, they're cool with going to secular court, it doesn't make a difference. It's like eating pork. They have both violated the prohibition. You cannot make a condition around it, and such a condition is considered to be null and void. There's a tshuva of the Rosh, in which the Rosh seems to talk about how if you have a line that was apparently common in his time to put into contracts, they insert a line into contracts that whatever obligation was described in the contract would be enforceable, Bein Bedinei Yisrael, Bein Bedinei Yaakov. It could be enforceable whether in the Jewish courts or in the non-Jewish courts. So it sounded on its face like the parties were contracting to agree that they could potentially bring the case, or if there would be a dispute, to the secular court. So the Rosh says you have to interpret the contract in such a way that the parties would not be agreeing to something which is ritually prohibited. So you have to reinterpret their words. So you have to say what they mean is that, let's say, Reuven summons Shimon to come to Beis Din, and Shimon refuses to come to Beis Din. So then, as we'll see, there is a dispensation that the Beis Din can give Reuven in such a circumstance to say, well, since Shimon is refusing to come to Beis Din, and we have no authority, say you're living in a country where they have no ability to compel Shimon to come to the Beis Din, so it's not fair for Reuven to have to lose out, so we're going to give Reuven dispensation to bring Shimon to secular court. But that's only after Beis Din gives the dispensation. So says the Rosh, it must be that that's what the contract means. When parties enter into a contract and they say, Bein Medinei Yisrael, Bein Medinei Yaakov, that must be what they mean. Now, there is a sma in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch, Simen Chav Vav of Choshen Mishpat, who says, well, it must be that the Rosh means that if it's possible to reinterpret their words in that way. But let's say you know that what the parties really meant to say was that Reuven would have the right to take Shimon to civil court, that they were putting that in the contract. So then if Reuven would have certain rights in civil court that he wouldn't have in Beis Din, he would have the right to bring Shimon to civil court in order to enforce those rights. So the Taz, Shreis Chai V'Kayim against the Sma, how can he say such a thing? This is in blatant opposition to the clear halacha psuka, the clear unambiguous halacha, that this would be a violation of a ritual prohibition, and it cannot be subject to the contract of the parties, and that seems to be the general consensus of the poskim. The only thing that's added by the Maharshal is that the Maharshal says that let's say you are entering into a contract with somebody who insists on putting into the contract such a clause. You know, you're dealing with somebody who's not so religious, a Jew who's bound by the Torah, but they're not so religious, and you're in business. And in business, a standard business contract has at the end of the contract two standard paragraphs. One is called choice of law, and one is called choice of forum. Choice of law clause says the parties agree that this contract shall be governed according to the laws of New York, New Jersey, whatever it is. And then there's a choice of forum clause. The choice of forum clause says that this contract shall be enforceable in any court of competent jurisdiction in the state of New York, for example. So obviously, if you're a from Yid, so you look at this and you say, wait, that's no good. We have to put in the contract that we agree that any dispute that we have shall be brought to Beis Din. But let's say the other Jew that you're entering into the business deal with says, nothing doing. I'm not changing the contract, and you really want to get this business deal done. So are you allowed to enter into such a contract? So it says the Yam Shel Shlomo, the only prohibition is voluntarily going to secular court. Entering into such a contract is not a problem. If the other party insists on putting this into the contract and they're not going to sign the contract otherwise, so you could put it in the contract. And then in the event that you ever have a dispute, you try to take the person to Beis Din. Hopefully they'll do tshuva. If the person refuses to go to Beis Din, so then the Beis Din will give them you the right to go to secular courts. It says the Yam Shel Shlomo. Here you know ahead of time that the person will refuse to go to Beis Din because they're insisting on inserting this contractual clause. So you don't even need the reshus of the Beis Din. It's deemed to have been implicitly given that you have permission by the Beis Din to take this fellow to secular court because he's already indicated from the outset that he's refusing to go to a Beis Din and will only agree to adjudicate the case in secular court, unless you know otherwise. This can be differentiated from, say, a case of ribbis. If I enter into a ribbis transaction with somebody, when I sign the contract says I'm loaning $10 and the person will pay me back $12, give me $2 in interest, I have violated a ribbis prohibition from the moment in which I have signed the contract. There is no violation of any prohibition at the time that this contract is signed that has a choice of forum clause, because I'm still prepared to go to Beis Din. It's just that the other person is insisting on inserting such a clause, so Yam Shel Shlomo is mechadesh based on this Rosh that would not necessarily be prohibited. Yes?
You don't have a heter from the Beis Din when you're signing it. Aren't you over the iser of the Iver, because maybe Yam Shel Shlomo will have to record, you don't have that heter when he's taking it to court?
You don't have which hat to when you go to court. Well, this is a question. The Yam Shel Shlomo is making a very big assumption, and maybe we'll get back to this. He's making an assumption that if you know for sure that the other fellow is such a reprobate that he is definitely not going to go to Beis Din no matter what, that you don't even have to bother contacting the Beis Din in the first place to try to get this guy to go to Beis Din, you could just take him straight to secular court. It's almost like you have a built-in implicit permission from the Beis Din. That is not necessarily muskum, not necessarily agreed upon by all of the deus. We'll have to see as we go a little bit further. It's a very good question, though. Very good question. Now, another question that arises is, let's say the Beis Din doesn't really have authority to enforce its decision. There's a Medrash Tanhuma at the beginning of Parsha Shoftim that says, look, the Torah says, Shoftim is Shoterim, Titen Lecha B'chol Sherecha. You have to have judges, and you have to have Shoterim, and you have to have police officers who will be able to enforce the Beis Din's decision. So he says, the Medrash says, Imein Shoterim, Ein Shoftim. If you have no enforcement mechanism for the Beis Din's decision, so then there are no Shoftim, then there are no Dayonim either. The Aruch Chaim HaKadosh in his commentary to the Torah, right there in Parsha Shoftim, says, We see from here that there's no mitzvah, there's no commandment of minoi dayonim, of appointing a bezdin, when you cannot have an enforcement mechanism. Now, thank God we do have an enforcement mechanism here in this country, in most countries. The enforcement mechanism is, in fact, the secular court system. The bezdin is able to operate as an arbitration tribunal according to what's called arbitration law. Arbitration law says that parties can agree that they're going to adjudicate their dispute outside of court. They're going to submit their dispute to the American Arbitration Association, the American Board of Architects and Engineers, or for that matter, they can submit their dispute to an arbitration tribunal under religious auspices. It could be under Sharia law, it could be under Jewish law, and that's perfectly enforceable under arbitration law. And once the parties sign an arbitration agreement that they agree to go to Beis Din and to be bound by the decision of Beis Din, Beis Din follows whatever procedural protocols are required by the arbitration statute that are generally consistent with halakha anyway. You can't have ex parte communications with the parties. You can't be fraud or duress. Ex parte means that there can't be communications of one party with the tribunal outside of the presence of the other party. Whenever the parties submit, the one party submits their argument to the Beis Din, the other party is present as well, so that they hear everything that the Beis Din is hearing. That's ex parte. Similarly, that the parties have to be allowed to be represented by legal counsel, that you can't have bribes, you know, things of that sort that the halacha is in agreement with as well. So that's not such a problem. We're happy to allow the parties to be represented by counsel if that's what's necessary in order for the decision to be enforceable. And then the decision can be enforceable. Now, there are certain types of cases where, as a public policy matter, the courts of various states have said that they're not subject to enforcement through arbitration tribunals, because they're such sensitive matters that the courts will only enforce decisions that have been made by a court of competent jurisdiction, as opposed to an arbitration tribunal. Like, for example, if there's a matrimonial case, so arbitration tribunals are generally given authority to decide the disposition of assets between a husband and wife. They could even issue a decision regarding spousal support after the divorce. They could even issue a decision regarding child support, as long as they follow the child support standards guidelines that are articulated by the state in question. But in certain states, including New York and Illinois, arbitration tribunal is not able to issue a decision about child custody, because the courts take the role of parents patriae, that they are the guardians of the children, and nobody else can assume the role of deciding what's in the best interests of the children when it comes to a child custody determination. In New Jersey, it's not true. In New Jersey, shortly after there was a case that was heard by the Beis Din of America, when I was the menahel there, we were dealing with a very complicated and very testy divorce case in New Jersey, where we were dealing with child custody determinations as well. And the husband went to the court and he wanted to take away the Beis Din's jurisdiction. He didn't like the decisions of the Beis Din and said that the Beis Din has no right to rule in these matters. And the court said, we don't want to rule in these matters. We think the Beis Din is doing a great job. So shortly after they issued that ruling, there was a ruling from the Supreme Court of New Jersey that said henceforth, it was the Forsey versus Forsey decision, said henceforth, all arbitration tribunals shall have authority to decide child custody matters as well. So I don't know if it was just a coincidence that that decision came out around the same time. I'd like to think it wasn't a coincidence. However, in most states, or many states, Beis Din doesn't have authority to issue a decision that would be enforceable. So does that mean that one parent in a custody dispute has the right to take the other parent to secular court? So some would say that if Beis Din doesn't have enforcement power, not only is there not a mitzvah to set up the Beis Din, but even if a Beis Din was set up, because it can handle many cases, if there's a specific type of case that it can't handle, so then there is no obligation to go to Beis Din as opposed to secular court. But Rabbi Bleich and others write that it's not so, that it's just an obligation the parties have to follow on their own the decision of the Beis Din. The Beis Din should try to make its decision as airtight and bulletproof as possible, so that it will be respected as much as possible by the lawyers and the members of the court system, but it should still be brought to the Beis Din. And in fact, The Beis Din of America in New York has heard many child custody dispute matters over the years, despite the fact that technically speaking it's not enforceable. It just does it in a way of what you might call collaborative arbitration, where there is an understanding between the parties and the lawyers for the parties from the get-go that they agree that they will incorporate the decision of the Beis Din into a comprehensive divorce agreement between the parties. And once the parties sign on that comprehensive divorce agreement, Then the courts will honor the decision of the Beis Din since it's been signed off upon by the parties and the lawyers, and that's the way that the parties should approach this type of case, as opposed to bringing it to secular court, which still would remain an isser. One has to take the prohibition very seriously. Yes, you had your hand up. Yes, but it's okay. We'll take your question first, then we'll take the other question. Okay, so the difference is like this, that did they sign that they're going to follow the Beis Din at the beginning of the proceeding or at the end of the proceeding? What is not recognized by New York when it comes to child custody determinations is, let's say the husband and wife signed an arbitration agreement that they agree to be bound by the Beis Din decision. The Beis Din issues a decision, and one of the parties, let's say the husband doesn't like the decision and doesn't want to follow it. The wife wants to enforce the decision, so the courts have said in the past she can't enforce that decision because it's regarding child custody, and the arbitration tribunal, in this case the Beis Din, cannot issue a binding decision when it comes to arbitration. But if they sign after the decision, And on the signature page of the decision, after the Dayanim have signed, the parties themselves sign, and by the way, we agree with everything that's written above, and we accept this decision upon ourselves after the fact, and we're prepared to incorporate this into our divorce settlement agreement, so then that would be respected by the court. Unless, of course, the court finds that it's blatantly, in their opinion, against the best interests of the children, but that's unlikely to happen, since the Beis Din also is generally responsible. Beis Din is careful to use child therapists and the like to ensure that the determination is made based on a consideration of what's in the best interest of the children. Yes?
So, it was basically that question. When you use this kind of sign at the end mechanism, the best is relying on the goodwill of the parties up until the very end, meaning they don't have an ability.
Yes, but you could view it almost like a mediation. You know, Beis Din can do mediation too. What's the difference between mediation and arbitration? Mediation is there's no arbitration agreement. You just sit down with the parties and you try to work out a mutual agreement. So if you could do that, where you just work out an amicable agreement between the parties and have them sign off on it in the presence of the Beis Din, so that would work as well. So when it's a child custody type of dispute, so what the Beis Din does is maybe just an enhanced form of a mediation proceeding. It's just that they work together with the parties and their lawyers, and they say, look, we all agree that in the event the parties are not able to agree on every single point, they'll accept whatever are the recommendations of the Beis Din, and lawyers agree that they will incorporate that into a comprehensive divorce settlement. Generally speaking, when the Beis Din does its job responsibly and it's using experts and the like, you know, in arriving at its conclusion, the parties and the lawyers realize that there's no point in not carrying out the Beis Din's decision, because even if they relitigate it in court, it's very likely they would just reach the same result, but it would be like $300,000 later. So we've never found this to be a problem. Now, another possible scenario is where you don't have Dayanim who are qualified in a particular city. This used to happen, you know, many years ago. In particular, you have very, very small towns. In some small towns, they would have to have a Beis Din to adjudicate various matters of dispute, but they didn't have people who are qualified Talmidei Chachamim. So the Gemara at the beginning of Perek Zeborah in Maseches Sanhedrin, in Daf Chav Gimel, I think, speaks about the idea of our Kol Shebesuria. Speaks about the idea that you would have certain types of courts that were made up of Jews, but they were not necessarily made up of big Talmidei Chachamim. So the Rashba writes in a tshuva that if you have a town, this is memorialized and recorded in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Ches, that in Chol Shemishpat, that if you have a town where there are no Talmidei Chachamim, so the elders of the area can appoint three people who will sit as the quote-unquote Dayanim. They're not going to be able to paskin based on laws of the Torah or Shulchan Aruch, but they're not going to adjudicate based on a separate civil law system either. So they're not going to be Meir Miyah Neged Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, and they're also not the civil court, so one's not going to be miyakir shem alilim. They'll just decide based upon their seikel or yosher, based on whatever is sensible under the circumstances. So that also is considered to be an acceptable alternative, because even though one doesn't have necessarily top-notch dayanim, but at the very least, they are taking steps to avoid the violation of the isser arkos of going to the civil courts. That's what the Rashba says you should do under those circumstances. Now, the Gemara, as you may recall, those who learned Baba Kama, even the beginning of Sanhedrin, talks about how does Beis Din have authority to adjudicate cases altogether nowadays, you know, in the first place, when we don't have smuchin, we don't have dayanim who have smicha directly from Moshe Rabbeinu or from those who receive smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. So how can we adjudicate cases? So you may recall, the Gemara says it's based on a principle of shlichus sayu ka'avdinun, that we are considered to be agents of the dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara there was talking about how can we adjudicate cases in Bavel when there's no smicha in Bavel. So the Gemara said, well, there's smicha in Eretz Yisrael, so the dayanim in Bavel are agents of the dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. So Tosfos at the end of Gittin says, not only is there a principle of shlichus sayu ka'avdinun geographically, but there's a principle of shlichus sayu ka'avdinun even when it comes to time, that on a temporal level, that we can say, even when there are no dayanim, even in Eretz Yisrael who have smicha, we could say the dayanim of today are considered to be the agents of the dayanim of yesteryear, that we're carrying on their agency to be able to adjudicate cases. But the Gemara says this agency is limited to certain types of monetary cases. It has to be a type of case which is shchiach, a milsa de shchicha, something that happens on a regular basis, v'yesh bo chisar and kis, where there is some sort of a monetary loss involved as well. So there's a whole dispute among the different poskim, so which cases are excluded. So we know that we exclude, for example, penalty cases, right? If you steal money, so technically for Geneva, you have to pay double damages, kepa, but there's no chisar and kis in the double damage, in the penalty damage amount. So we say that the Bate Din nowadays have no right to adjudicate kepa. They can only adjudicate the actual Geneva, the actual theft itself and the amount that was stolen, but they can't impose a double payment for the restitution to be paid by the thief. However, what about the types of cases where there really is a monetary loss, but we say, oh, it's not considered to be shchiach? So can those cases be brought to secular court because the dayanim don't have authority? Like, for example, there is a dispute between the Achronim, the Shach, and the Shlus Yaakov, have a dispute about what about damages that are caused by a pit that somebody dug. They dug a pit, somebody falls into the pit, they hurt themselves. So that can be, I had a case where there was somebody who had a pothole in their bungalow colony, and somebody's kid fell into the pothole with their bicycle and they got hurt. They wanted to go after the owner of the bungalow colony, and they said that we hold like the Shach, that this is not something which is considered common, therefore it's not subject to shlichus sayu. We want to take the person to court as opposed to taking them to Beis Din. And the other person said, no, I want to go to Beis Din. So we will, first of all, there is the opinion of the Shlus Yaakov that this type of damage would be subject to shlichus sayu anyway. We pointed out, however, if you look in the Beis Yosef in Simen Chavav, he quotes the Sefer Trumos. Sefer Trumos says very explicitly that even if it is a type of damage which is not included within shlichus sayu, there's still an obligation to go to Beis Din. The fact that Beis Din doesn't have the authority from the original dayanim to adjudicate the case in strict accordance with Jewish law principles doesn't mean that they don't have any authority. It just means that the case is brought to Beis Din. Either they say, I'm sorry, we can't award damages, or they'll say, based on our authority as a rabbinical court, we're going to impose a nidoy. We're going to impose some type of an excommunication upon the person who caused the damage until they pay enough money to satisfy the other individual, as opposed to issuing a traditional type of judgment. But it still has to, or Beis Din has the authority to say that we're authorizing the case to be brought to secular court, but all of that has to be subject to the determination of Beis Din. Even when there is no shlichus sayu, a party does not have the right to go to the Beis Din in the first instance. Now, another application of this principle. The person is not authorized, I'm sorry, thank you. A person is not authorized to go to court in the first instance. They have to go to Beis Din in the first instance. Correct. Okay, now, another application is with respect to a lawyer. If a person is called upon as a lawyer to represent a Jewish party who's bringing another Jewish party to court, so they are in violation of Lifnei Iver. if there are other Jewish lawyers who would also be prepared, or non-Jewish lawyers who would also be prepared to represent this individual in a civil court. So then the lawyer would not, strictly speaking, be in violation of Lifnei Iver, because the person can find somebody else to represent them in civil court, but the lawyer would be in violation of Misayeya de Ovrei Avera, de Nisa de Rabbanan, rabbinical prohibition of even when a person can go elsewhere to carry out their prohibition. If you are the one who facilitates their violation of the prohibition, you have violated the rabbinical edict against helping somebody violate an avera. So therefore, strictly speaking, it's problematic for somebody to serve as a lawyer for a plaintiff who brings a plaintiff Jewish party, who brings a defendant Jewish party to the civil court system. Is there any way out of that? So this is something that the poskim discuss as to whether maybe if the plaintiff in question is somebody who's a mumer, there's somebody who is completely in defiance of Torah laws in terms of the way they live their life. They're a completely non-observant Jew. So maybe under those circumstances, there is an opinion of the Shach that the rabbinic prohibition of Misayeya does not apply to helping somebody who's a mumer violate an avera. There's an Oda Behuda that says even if there's a particular avera that they violate, they don't violate all the averas, but this avera they violate regularly, so they're a mumer with respect to this avera. However, it's best not to rely upon these types of heterim, but to steer parties towards coming to a Bezdin. At the very least, I think that if somebody's a lawyer and they are approached by a Jewish party to take another Jewish party to court, they should either try to demur or steer them or tell them about the possibility of Bezdin. At the very least, steer them towards a non-civil court setting, such as a different arbitration setting that is not bound by the civil court system, that would technically not be an Isser or Kos. But it's something that one has to be mindful of if they go into the practice of law as well. There are some poskim who add as well that it would be prohibited if somebody is called upon to be a witness in a case where one Jewish party brought another Jewish party to civil court, and then you're asked to testify on behalf of that plaintiff party because they really should have brought the case to Bezdin as opposed to civil court. You should really try to avoid being a witness in that case. And the Sefer Seder Adin, he says that if the court itself summons you to testify and is going to get you into trouble for not testifying, so then as a matter of Chilul Hashem, it would be appropriate to follow the court's bidding, but not to follow the bidding of the Jewish party who's transgressing a prohibition by taking another Jewish party to a civil court, as opposed to taking them to Bezdin. Okay, you got all of that so far?
Question?
Yes, please.
Is that the, let's say, something gets a traffic ticket? Is that that's foul? So, you're going to the court because you're summoned. You want to represent yourself. That would be included.
A traffic ticket is not between two Jews. That's between the government and yourself. So there's nothing wrong with going to the civil court in that case. If you are brought to the civil court, this is a good question.
Yeah. Or one Jew,
let's say that, I'm sorry?
Or one Jew against the guy. Well,
or if you have a Jew against the goy, we'll get to that shortly. But let's say you're the defendant in the case. You're not the plaintiff. Another Jew summoned you to come to civil court. You're not the one who's going to civil court. So Rav Avadya Yosef says that if you're the defendant in the case, then you have the right to defend yourself because you weren't the one who turned to the civil court in the first place. The other person turned to the civil court. If you don't defend yourself and represent yourself, then you're going to end up suffering and losing as a result. You have the right to be matzil as atzmecha. You have the right to rescue yourself. That's not being meirim yad negin Moshe Rabbeinu. The other person was meirim yad. The other person forsook the Torah. The other person is giving glory and respect to the civil court system. You're not. You're just the one who was dragged in there. Everybody knows that you were dragged in there. So he says that it would be permissible to serve as a lawyer representing a defendant in a civil court action, the one who was summoned, as opposed to representing the plaintiff. Now, let's say, however, that the case is neither brought to Bezdin nor to the civil court system. What are the other possibilities? We mentioned them. Let's say it's a case that's brought to the American Arbitration Association, where I've had this, where people enter into a contract and the other parties want to insert in the contract that the dispute shall be heard by the American Arbitration Association. I had a rabbi who was entering into a rabbinical contract, and he said, my board of directors, they don't trust Bate Din. They figure that Bate Din are always going to rule in favor of the rabbi. It's not true, by the way. They rule in favor of whoever, deserves to win.
which is, you know, may always be the rabbi, but it's not always the rabbi. Okay, but in his case, the board said we don't trust Eddie Besdin. We're not going to say we want to go to court, but we want to submit to any dispute to the American Arbitration Association. So is that permissible? So strictly speaking, there's a Rabbi Kiva Eger in the Choshen Mishpat Siman Gimel. He quotes the Maharshach. The Maharshach says that if the custom is in a particular, let's say, industry, let's say in the diamond industry, that whenever there's a dispute between two merchants, they always bring it in front of an arbitration board of those merchants, b'fnei ha-socherim, like the diamond dealer arbitration board, and they're the ones who will decide the case according to the minhagei ha-socherim, according to the customs and practices of that industry. So it says the Maharshach, quoted by Rabbi Akiva Eger, that's perfectly legitimate. Somebody says, I want to go in front of the arbitrators of my industry because this is the minhag, this is what everybody does. Says Rabbi Akiva Eger, that person has the right to insist upon that rather than the case being heard in front of Besdin. Why is that? Because this is not a case of arkos. This is not a case where the arbitrators are considered to be functionaries of the secular court system. They operate in a separate and distinct fashion, and they're also not duty-bound to apply the secular law. They're just applying the minhagei ha-socherim, applying whatever are the customs of the marketplace, of that industry, and that's something which is recognized by halacha as well, like we have in the Gemara in Bava Metzia and Daf Ayin Daled, where Rava says that if the minhag is that a kinyan is consummated, that the way in which you effectuate a transaction is through situmta, through like a handshake or something like that, even though there's no Torah basis for it, but that's something which is the custom in the industry. That's what all the merchants do. So then that's considered to be a binding transaction. So to over here, he says, we considered whatever is in the realm of minhag ha-socherim, as long as it doesn't violate any ritual prohibition, like, for example, charging forbidden interest, that would be enforceable and acceptable as a matter of halacha. There is a sidebar discussion about how far we would apply this. So, for example, let's say it's not the arbitration board of the industry, but let's say that one part. So, what did I say in that case to the rabbi who shul wanted to enter into that contract? So, I said, technically speaking, in most cases, that would be acceptable. Now, in most cases, it would be acceptable to sign such a clause. You're not obligated to sign such a clause. If a person absolutely, you say you only want to go to Besdin, and they say we refuse to go to Besdin, you're not obligated to go to their arbitration tribunal. In such a case, a Besdin could give you a heter to go to court if they refuse to go to Besdin. But for you to agree to go to a separate arbitration tribunal that's just following their own customs and practices, and they're not part of the civil court system, so there's no prohibition to enter into such a contract, there's no prohibition even to submit the dispute in front of such a tribunal, that is perfectly permissible. However, if you're dealing with a shul board, I said, so there's a comment that Rav Moshe Feinstein makes in one of his tshuvas, where Moshe Feinstein says that if you have people who are considered to be official emissaries of the community, like the Zion Tuvei Yair, that they are appointed to take care of the religious affairs for the community. They're like the heads of the synagogue of the community. So he says it's implicit that anybody who's appointed to that religious communal capacity is supposed to act only in accordance with the ways of the Torah and according to the strict laws of the Torah. The strict laws of the Torah are that when you have a dispute, it should be adjudicated according to the laws of the Torah in front of a bezin. So I said, maybe if this was like a business contract you were entering into, so it would be legitimate for the other side to say they want to go in front of the American Arbitration Association, but not if it's a shul contract. If it's a shul contract, they have to agree to go in front of a bezin. If they don't trust any particular bezin, let them do a zabla, where, you know, they'll pick a particular rabbi they're comfortable with, you'll pick a rabbi, and those two rabbis will pick a third rabbi, but not comfortable with such an arbitration clause outside of the realm of bezin in the context of a shul contract. Otherwise, it would be okay. So there's a discussion about what if, instead of it being so this is like the American Arbitration Association. It's not a, let's say, it's not an industry arbitration tribunal, but just a tribunal made up of non-Jews. So here, there is a comment that's made by the Aruch HaShulchan and Siman Chav Beis. It's based on a discussion between the Shach and the Nesivas HaMishpat, based on a Machlokas Mechaber and Ramah in Siman Chav Beis. But the upshot is that the Aruch HaShulchan says it depends. If this arbitration board is set up so that they're going to adjudicate cases only in accordance with secular law, so then that itself is a problem. Ah, you're not miyakir alilim, you're not appearing in front of the civil court, but you are being meir miyad neged Moshe, Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu. You are disregarding and repudiating the system of law of Torah by accepting an alternative system of law. They are only following a civil law system, even though they're not functionaries of the civil court, but nonetheless, they are doing all of their decisions in accordance with civil law principles, so that would be a problem. But if they're going to decide the case according to their seichel hayosher, according to whatever they think is fair and just and right under the circumstances without regard to any legal system, so then, says the Aruch HaShulchan, that would be perfectly fine. So on this basis, there's a tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer where he talks about the following situation. Let's say, this is in Eretz Yisrael, there was a law in the books. The law in the books said that in the event that you would have, say, a condominium association of houses, and there'd be some dispute between neighbors, so rather than having it brought in front of a court, it would be brought in front of a pakid. There would be somebody who would be appointed by the condominium association who would be like the community arbitrator, and all of the disputes would be brought in front of that individual, and they would adjudicate the case in accordance with what they felt was fair and just and equitable under the circumstances using their seichel hayosher. So says that Tzitz Eliezer, he thinks this is basically the same thing as what Rabbi Akiva Eger was talking about. The person is just using their good sense as to what is common practice, minag hasochim, call it the minag medina, when it comes to how condominium associations and the various rights and privileges of the homeowners function, and therefore this would not be a violation of our code. So supposedly, I saw in a sefer Eila Mishpatim that supposedly he said, I heard this al pi hashmua, so I don't have any hard evidence of this. This is mi pi hashmua. He said, I heard through the grapevine that Rav El Yashiv sent a letter to the Tzitz Eliezer after the Tzitz Eliezer wrote this tshuva, and Rav El Yashiv said, you made a mistake on this one. I guess he did it privately, he didn't want to shame in public or disagree in public, but he sent him a letter saying, I don't think that you got this correct. And the argument as to why this principle shouldn't apply in the Tzitz Eliezer's case is maybe you could figure it out. What's the difference in the case where the parties just on their own say they're going to go to the American Arbitration Association in this case of the Tzitz Eliezer? In this case, it is memorialized in the statute. It's an actual statute, so it becomes on that level arguably part of the court system. Since the statute says you must go in front of this individual to adjudicate your cases, so arguably that is considered to be part of the court system. It's like the Shulchan Aruch writes in Simen Samaches and Kol Shemishpat, let's say that you agree that you'll have a non-Jew just arbitrate the case using their judgment. However, this non-Jew is not sitting in their living room. They're sitting in small claims court as part of the court system itself. So the Shulchan Aruch says, if you have a pshara, if you have even just an arbitration that is not based on applying the statutes and the principles of law of the legal system, but it's done in the context of the court system itself, it's like you have one chamber for regular court cases, then you have another chamber next door for the small claims cases that are going to be brought in front of an arbitrator, and you want to bring a case against another Jew in small claims court. So this also would be a violation of our kos. What is the problem over here? The arbitrator is not going to be applying secular law in deciding the case. They'll just be using their common sense in deciding the case. So the problem is, you're miyakir shei malilim. You have the first problem because you're giving respect to their court system by going to a facet of their court system in order to adjudicate the dispute by going to the small claims court. I had to go to small claims court once, not as a plaintiff, as a defendant. We once adjudicated a case in Beis Din, and there was a person who was one of the parties who didn't like our decision. So sometimes the party doesn't like the arbitration decision, so they go to court and they try to get the decision overturned. So this person thought they would be more clever. Instead of going to get the decision overturned, they would bring a small claims case, which costs a lot less money to bring, just to receive the fees that they paid for the Din Torah in return. because their argument was that they didn't get what they paid for. They paid for justice, and they got injustice. Since the decision was a wrong decision in their opinion, therefore they wanted their money returned to them. They wanted the fees paid back to them. Whatever the fees were, $350, $500, it qualified as a small claims case. So they brought me. I was a defendant, so I had no choice but to go. I wasn't the plaintiff. I was the defendant, so I had the right to go to small claims court. And the case was presented in front of the arbitrator. The arbitrator turned to me, and he said, oh, I'm an arbitrator, so I just try to, like, you know, make peace. So he wants $500. Well, you split it down the middle. Split it down the middle. Pay $250. So I say, hey, split it down the middle. So that would be a repudiation of the integrity of the Besdin system, where people have to have respect for the decisions that we hand down. We have a process. We hand down a decision. People have to respect it. I can't make a compromise. I'm not the owner. I'm not the bialim over this to make a compromise. This is something which is divinely inspired. So I don't have any authority over that. So he said, okay, that makes sense. So we won the case. I don't know. He said, I got the decision 2 days later. We won the case. So it was good. As I was leaving the courtroom, so the fellow who brought the case against us says, I'm really bringing in small claims because I figured that if I win this case, then I'll be able to show that the decision was really wrong. And then I'll bring this small claims decision to the regular civil court in order to get the decision overturned. So thank God that didn't happen. That was my experience in small claims court. In the meantime, they towed my car because I had parked my car behind a tree and then no parking sign wasn't visible. So I came out of the decision and I found that my car had been towed away. So I took a picture and I showed that the no parking sign was invisible, and I sent a complaint about that, and I got that overturned as well. Thank God, so it all worked. Yeah. Yes?
What if you have two corporations and the majority owners, the majority shareholders are both Jews, but their stakeholders can be anyone. So what do you do in such a case?
So it depends. If, you have, say, people, you have a corporation, and the corporation is owned by Jews, or primarily by Jews, who have the right to bind everybody in the corporation to make decisions on behalf of the corporation. So then they are held responsible to agree to submit any dispute involving the corporation to a Besdin. But if you only have minority holders who are Jewish, and the ones who really are calling the shots are non-Jewish, and they're not going to agree to go to Besdin, so then the Jewish minority owners can't be faulted for, having the case adjudicated in civil court. So it really depends on how much control they have. And that's very much a case-by-case determination. I can't give an absolute answer because it really varies very much case-by-case. All right? Now, one of the big questions that was dealt with by the Gedolei HaPoskim going back really 70 years ago when Medina Yisrael was established was, can you have a secular court system within Eretz Yisrael? Because here you have a system of courts called the Bagatz, right? You have a system of courts in Eretz Yisrael, but it's not run according to Torah principles. It's run according to a law system that was based upon Ottoman law, was based upon British law. It was based upon other legal systems other than the Torah. On the other hand, all of the judges were Jewish, because of the Jewish state, so all the judges were Jewish. So do we say that this is also an example of, there are two different facets to the prohibition that the Torah describes? It's Ashir Tassim Lifnehem. You're not allowed to bring cases in front of anyone other than Lifnehem, the Jewish judges, the Dayanim, the qualified Dayanim. So there are two different things, two different exclusions that are learned from this pasuk in the Gemara and Gittin. One is, v'lo lifnei hakum, you can't bring cases in front of civil court, but the other exclusion is, v'lo lifnei adyotos, you can't bring a case against in front of Jewish judges who are not qualified. We saw, however, that this second exclusion is not as absolute as the first one. We spoke about our kol shevasuria. If you don't have qualified dayanim, so then you can appoint Jewish judges to use their seikel ayasha, to use their common sense, as the Rashba says, to adjudicate cases. And the Ramban writes that if I have two parties who both voluntarily agree that they're going to submit to their dispute in front of Jewish judges who are not certified, who are hedyotos, they didn't get a smicha in yadin yadin, they're not so learned, they're not so knowledgeable, but you agree that you'll be bound by their decision, so that also would be acceptable according to what the Ramban says. So there were those who argued, so if you have a court system set up in Israel, made up of non-dayanim, they're not the yadin yadin dayanim, and they're not deciding according to principles of the Torah, but everybody would accept this court system upon themselves. So maybe that should be valid according to halacha. So the Chazon Ish wrote very, very strongly against this, as did Tzvi Pesach Frank, as did Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, as did the Tzitz Eliezer. Everybody pretty much got up and railed against this proposal, which unfortunately eventually did materialize, that we have a separate court system in Israel which does not function according to the laws of the Torah, l'da'avoneinu. And the Chazon Ish said that while there might be, you know, some allowance in an individual case, that you can have two parties who will accept hedyotas upon themselves, but you cannot have an allowance for people carte blanche to accept a legal system upon themselves that is in contravention to Torah. Here, this is the ultimate, says the Chazon Ish, in being meirim yad neged Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu, in raising up your arm in defiance against the Torah that we have received through Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah of that has been given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to actually be an Eretz Yisrael, to have our own state, and to reject the Torah system of law that we have and replace it with a totally different system. So this, says the Chazon Ish, is such an egregious violation of Lifnehem Velo Lifnei Hedyotos that it constitutes a Meirim Yad Negen Moshe Rabbeinu. If you have the Alkol Shebisurya, you have the judges who are appointed because you don't have Dayanim Mumchim. In Baruch Hashem, we have Dayanim Mumchim in Eretz Yisrael. And these Dayanim are just put there as a stopgap measure, and they're not representing that they're following a separate standalone legal system, so that can be countenanced in certain circumstances. However, to just replace the Torah system with a totally different system of law, especially when you can provide for proper Dayanim, so this is a complete repudiation of Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore is the worst possible thing. In fact, Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna said this is worse than a regular court system of Arkos, because outside of Eretz Yisrael, when you have the civil court system, it's legitimate for the non-Jews, at least as a fulfillment of their mandate to follow the Zion mitzvahs b'nei Noach, and one of those mitzvahs is dinim, to establish a court system. So therefore, the courts are legitimate, at least on some basic level. But this court system is completely illegitimate, because there's no basis for a Jewish state to establish a secular court system. So therefore, it's even worse than the Arkos that are outside of Eretz Yisrael. So an argument that was brought by some of the proponents, including Professor Menachem Elon, who later sat as a judge on the Israeli Supreme Court, and he was a Talmid Chacham, and you may know him as the founder of the whole Mishpat Ivri system, right? So Menachem Elon made the argument that if you look at the description of the Meiri in Sanhedrin Daf Chav Gimel, when he's describing our Kol Shebisurya and the way that they go about adjudicating cases, so the Meiri says, Donin ba'omen datam uvechukim minimusim. They decide according to the judgment of their minds and according to various statutes that they come across. So he said, look, the Meiri himself said that the judges who were appointed, who are accepted by certain Jewish communities to be their judges, and this was allowed according to halacha, would decide cases according to chukim minimusim, according to the protocols and laws of wherever they happen to live, because they didn't know halacha, but they knew whatever the laws were of these government where they lived. So we see that this is legitimate. So Rav Avram Sherman, in an article that he wrote, I think appropriately countered this argument. He said, if you look at the Meiri doesn't say that they're bound by the chukim minimusim, by whatever happened to be the various statutes and laws of the locale where they live. Just says they can decide that way if they want to. Sometimes they'll say, oh, we know this particular law when it comes to landlord-tenant law, and we're going to apply that law. And sometimes they would say, we're deciding according to what we think is just and fair. Lefi omen datenu. It's an option. They decide be omen datam uvechukim minimusim. They can pick from any number of different frames of reference. But if you have a court system which is set up specifically and exclusively to only decide cases according to a secular legal system based upon Ottoman law and based on British law, so that would be Meirim Yad Negin Moshe Rabbeinu, that would Negin Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, that would be a violation of repudiating Torah law, and therefore could not be allowed under any circumstances. Okay, now we have to ask, does somebody have their hand up? Okay, good. Now, you have to ask the next question. Under what circumstances do we say that when there is a dispute between two Jews, that we would allow for the case to be brought to secular court? So here there is a discussion as to what the allowance could be in the first place to permit somebody to ever go to secular court as opposed to Beis Din. If we started out saying that there is a ritual prohibition, that one has a ritual prohibition like eating chazir against going to secular court, so how can we ever allow somebody to be permitted to go to secular court under any circumstances? So for this, there are really two different sources that allow for the person to be given dispensation to go to secular court, okay? And this arises classically in the following scenario, where Reuven summons Shimon to go to Beis Din. Shimon refuses to go to Beis Din, so we say that the Beis Din gives Reuven the dispensation to take Shimon to secular court. So according to the Rosh, the basis for this is a Gemara in Baba Kama on Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Beis. The Gemara there says, Amle Rabba, the Rabba Bamari, Rabba asked Rabba Bamari, Minar Milsa Damiyinchi Karis Chaba Kolonach. How do we know that if you summon somebody and they don't answer you, Rami Guda Rabba Shadi Bey, you should take a giant wall and throw it upon them, okay? You know, you know the expression, you throw the book at them, so you throw the wall at them. You throw a giant wall at somebody. And that's all that the Gemara says. And it brings the pasuk, Yan Tiyatik, Lo Tiyatmi, Tumasik, Lo Titariot. But it just sounds like you called somebody, they didn't answer, so you could throw the wall at them. So what's going on over here? So the Rosh quotes a Paltoigon as saying that this Gemara is really saying this exact case. It's just kind of giving you a mushel or some type of a metaphor for what we are discussing. Reuven sheyesh lo tfiyah al Shimon. Reuven has a claim against Shimon misari lavo imo ledin, and Shimon refuses to come to the Beis Din. Shirashai lavio la'akol shel nochrim. So we see that Reuven has the right to bring Shimon to the court kedei lahotzi eshalom mitachas yado, in order to be able to recover that which he had claimed against Shimon. And what's the source? This Gemara. The person refuses to come to Beis Din, you could throw the wall at them. So this Gemara seems to indicate that it is a knas of some sort, that it's a knas, as a person being able to penalize an individual who refuses to come to Beis Din. They refuse to come to Beis Din, we throw the wall at them, that then that you could take them to secular court. Now, the other source that's quoted by the Sefer Trumos is the Mishnah in Gittin, on Peches Amud Beis. The Mishnah says that if I have a get, where the Beis Din would compel the husband to give his wife a get, and the man is refusing to comply, so then even if it is enforced through the non-Jews, that enforcement would be valid. The Ovdei Kochavim choftin also. The Ovdei Kochavim can take charge of the situation, and they can pressure and beat up the guy. V'omim lo asei ma shisol omim lecha. And they can say to him, do that which the Jewish court is requiring you to do. So says the Baal Trumos, on this basis, the Jewish court can give permission. The Jewish court can say, we have determined that Reuven really would have the right to file a claim of action in Beis Din. Shimon's refusing to go to Beis Din. Therefore, we give Reuven the right to collect his claim through the secular court system. So these are the two sources that allow for heter or kos. Now, what is the halakhic mechanism to explain why this should be allowed? So the Kesam Sofer and the Tshuva that I quoted earlier in Choshen Mishpat's Siman Gimel explains that in this type of scenario, the secular court serves as the shliach, serves as the agent of the Jewish court. In the same way that when the Jewish court, when the Beis Din issues a decision, we utilize the secular court system to enforce the decision, to marshal the assets of the person who's supposed to pay up, to foreclose on their property, or to garnish their wages, the same way that we utilize them as shotrim in that context, they could also be utilized in order to adjudicate the case in the first place when the defendant refuses to fulfill their halakhic obligation to appear in front of Beis Din, so that they are essentially serving as shluchim. The other explanation that's given by the Klei Chemda in Parshas Mishpatim, the Klei Chemda says that there is the obligation is only when the other party is prepared to submit to Beis Din. If the other party is not prepared to submit to Beis Din, a person doesn't have an obligation to lose their shirt. So in such a circumstance, they are not disrespecting Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu by going to court. They're only going to court because it would be impossible for them to collect otherwise because the first party is refusing to show up to Beis Din. So this could be an application of Ovid Inish Dina Lenafshe. A person's allowed to sometimes take the law into their own hands. This is the only way that they're going to be able to collect. Normally we say when it comes to the principle of Ovid Inish Dina Lenafshe that this is not does not extend to the ability of bringing a person to secular court. And so the Tatum HaZadesh, it says, Mechur Adorer, such a thing is considered to be revolting and to be improper. Nonetheless, that's only when you have the option of going to Beis Din. But here, since there is no option, it's no longer Mechur Adorer. So those are the two different explanations. Now, yes, go ahead. That's what it seems like. From the Gemara, again.
So the three explanations?
Well, the question is, what gives us the right to impose this knas, right? So you could say that Beis Din is authorizing the knas to be imposed upon the person. In other words, if it is a ritual prohibition, otherwise, so who is allowing this knas? What's the mechanism for the knas to take place if it would normally be prohibited to go to secular court? So how can we allow a knas of doing something which is prohibited? So this would be an explanation. Oh, it's operating through shlichut. Or, no, the prohibition goes away in this type of circumstance.
Do the
Achronim call this Rosh a knas? Well, yes, meaning that I don't know if uniformly across the board that everybody describes it as a knas. There is a discussion in the Sefer Divrei Mishpat by the Dayan Rav Chaim Kohn. It's the Breuer's Dayan. Rav Chaim Kohn explains it as a knas. So I guess I'm borrowing his depiction of it. I can't say that everybody necessarily describes it as a knas. In fact, what Rav Chaim Kohn points out is that a number of the Achronim conflate the two sugyos. That they say that it's really kind of hainu haf, just two different sides of the coin. But he says that really, if I'm just looking at the Gemara and Baba Kama in isolation, then it would appear to be functioning like a knas. The idea of you call somebody, they don't respond, throw the wall at him, sounds a little bit like a knas. So I'm describing it as such, but certainly it's, at the very least, it's a consequence. Okay, so we could certainly describe it as a consequence. Now, if I understand that the mechanism through which we would ever allow somebody to go to secular court when the other party refuses to go to Beis Din is through shlichus, so then it would seem that even when you would know that there's no way in the world that the other party is going to agree to go to Beis Din, you should still have Beis Din summon them in the first instance so that Beis Din can give the official heter dispensation to go to secular court, because otherwise it's difficult to argue that there's a shlichus, that there's an agency on the part of the Beis Din. So this could be perhaps the two different sides of the discussion in the Kesef HaKodshim. Kesef HaKodshim is commentary to Chosh Mishpat Simen Chavav, says if I have a completely fried Jew, I have somebody who's completely non-observant, somebody who is completely not keeping any mitzvos, and you know that they are certainly not going to agree to go to civil court. So he says that you don't have to summon them in the first place because it's just a waste of time. You know that they're not going to go to Beis Din, and you could just take them straight to court. Others disagree and say, no, you always have to summon the person in the first instance. And contemporary poskim say nowadays, when courts are so expensive and people look for alternative dispute resolution forums anyway to have a cheaper court process, so you can't take for granted that even somebody who's completely irreligious is not going to want to go to Beis Din. Maybe they will agree to go to Beis Din. I've had many cases where people who are otherwise not that religious agreed to go to Beis Din. I've had cases with non-Jews took other Jews to Beis Din because they felt that it would be a better process for them. So therefore, you can't really work with this assumption. You have to send this money to everybody. But another argument could be that if you hold like the Kassam Sofer, that the mechanism through which we would ever allow a heter or a kohos permission to go to civil court is only through the shlichus, only through the civil courts being an agent of the Beis Din, then that would be another reason to, even when you know for sure the person's not going to go to Beis Din, to first have them summoned at least one time by the Beis Din so that the Beis Din can give official reshus to permit the plaintiff to take the case to secular court as opposed to Beis Din. And it also would be an afkamin in terms of the Maharshal that we quoted earlier. We quoted the Amshel Shlomo that said that if a person put in their contract that they're only going to agree to adjudicate the case in secular court, then you don't have to bother getting permission from the Beis Din down the road in order to take them to secular court, because it could be presumed that's what they would want to do. But if you understand that the mechanism is shlichus, so maybe even in that case, it would be appropriate to turn to the Beis Din first. Now, another question which is discussed by the poskim is whether it is necessary for the Beis Din to determine that the plaintiff really has a winning claim according to halacha. You know, there are two problems. If you bring somebody to secular court when the Torah doesn't permit it, then one problem is that you violated the prohibition against going to secular court. The other problem is that you might recover more in the secular court than you would have recovered in the Beis Din, in which case, as Rabbi Akiva Eiger and others point out, whatever excess gains you have recovered in the secular court is going to be prohibited to you as gezel. It's going to be theft in your hands because you had no right to it. So the question is, what about this type of case where the defendant refuses to go to Beis Din? Does the Beis Din have to first establish that the claim that the plaintiff had is one that would be worthy of collection anyway in a Beis Din before authorizing the plaintiff to go to secular court? Because maybe the plaintiff will end up collecting more than what they are entitled to according to halacha. And even if there's no prohibition against going to arkos, they'll still have a prohibition of gezel. So some say, yeah, Beis Din gives the permission and then afterwards reviews what the decision of the secular court was. And if it determines that the plaintiff received more than what they should have, it tells the plaintiff, you got to return the excess amount to the defendant. That's what some say. However, Meir Auerbach, in his Sefer Imrei Bina, notes that this does not appear to be the general practice. He was a contemporary of the Maharsham. It appears that a contemporary, that the practice of most Bati Dinim, of Chaim Cohn points this out as well, is that when the defendant refuses to go to Beis Din, there's no determination by the Beis Din that the plaintiff probably would be able to collect in a secular, probably would be able to collect in Beis Din anyway, the amount that they're seeking before authorizing them to go to secular court. The Nesivas HaMishpat says this is absolutely necessary. The Aruch HaShulchan has kind of like a modified version of that, says that, well, it's difficult without being able to adjudicate the case to determine that the plaintiff would definitely be victorious, but the Beis Din should hear all of the plaintiff's claims in the absence of the other party and figure out whether, at least based on what the plaintiff is saying, whether al pi din, the plaintiff would be entitled to a certain recovery. Now, the truth of the matter is that based on the standard of the Aruch HaShulchan, at least arguably the Beis Din of America and the Bati Din I've been affiliated with, also CRC, Chicago Rabbinical Council, kind of follow that standard anyway, because we don't send a hazmana, we won't send a summons to a defendant in any case unless we review the claim. The administrator of the Beis Din reviews the claim of the plaintiff beforehand and determines that, at least assuming that everything that the plaintiff is alleging is correct, then the plaintiff would be entitled to some recovery. But if even assuming all the facts alleged by the plaintiff wouldn't be able to collect anything in any Beis Din, then the Beis Din won't even hear the case in the first place. So if we've even sent a summons, then it probably means that we've already made the determination that is required by the Aruch HaShulchan. In which case, it's not necessary to find the Teirim. Why is it that we just allow anybody to go to secular court if the other party refuses to go to Beis Din? Because we really do make some sort of determination along the lines of the Aruch HaShulchan ab initio. However, Chaim Cohn works with the assumption, like Rav Meir Auerbach, that it's not even necessary to make that level of determination if the defendant is absolutely refusing to go to Beis Din. And he argues that it's really dependent upon which is the source or which is considered to be kind of the more authoritative or controlling source of heter or kos. Is it the Mishnah in Gittin, which says, Ase ma shisol omim lecha, that the secular court has to be able to function on some level as the emissary of the Beis Din, saying, whatever the Beis Din would require you to do, that's what we're requiring you to do, no more and no less? Or is it the Gemara in Baba Kama that says, no, that if a person refuses to go to Beis Din, we just throw the book at them, we throw the wall at them, which would indicate that it's more of a knas. So it says of Chaim Cohn, it could be that the practice of many Batei Din, not to scrutinize whether the plaintiff really is collected, entitled to all the money that they end up receiving in a secular court, is based on a reliance really on the Gemara and Baba Kama, that it really functions like a knas. It functions like a knas in these circumstances. Now, you could say as well that if you hold like the Ksam Sofer, that it has to work as a shlichus, so maybe there's more of an argument that the plaintiff should only be able to collect that which they could have collected in Beis Din, but that's not mukhok, because you could say part of the shlichus is that Beis Din would say, no, we're appointing these secular courts as agents to impose a knas, and the knas is that they'd be able to collect more than they might be able to collect even in Beis Din. Another related discussion is what if a person has a chov borer? What do you mean? What do I mean by a chov borer?
There's a new point of another case where somebody could take a fellow Jew in a secular court. A new case, right?
Right now I'm talking about a new case.
New case, right.
Okay, so this could be a chov borer. A chov borer, if you have, let's say, a promissory note, which is an unambiguous obligation where there's like no way in the world that the defendant would have any kind of defense whatsoever that they'd be able to bring in Beis Din. It's just an unambiguous promise we know, and really it's just an enforcement action. It's nothing to be adjudicated. It's just an enforcement action. So the Maharsham says in a number of different places, the Maharsham says that he received the Kabbalah from the Beis Din of Buchach, that's the same as the author of the Kesef HaKadshim, that in this type of a situation, it's not, strictly speaking, necessary to go to Beis Din. As a Midas Chasidus, it's the right thing to do, but not strictly speaking that we would penalize anybody for not going to Beis Din in the first instance when they have a chov borer, when they have a completely unambiguous obligation. Because if there's a chov borer, he says that Beis Din doesn't have enforcement power anyway. You have to go to the secular courts if you want to enforce a Beis Din decision. And here it's almost as if the decision is already built into the case because there's no defense that the defendant is going to be able to allege the promissory note. Now, the reality is that while there are others who say this, you know, even more unequivocally, there's an essay in the Tehumen Journal by Rav Mordechai Eliyahu where he says this and others say this as well. It's very difficult to construct the scenario where this is really true because I've been involved in many cases where the plaintiff has a promissory note and the defendant says, yes, I know you have a promissory note, but I'm not obligated to pay it for reasons X, Y, and Z. Or I admit that I'm obligated to pay it, but I don't have the money right now, and there has to be some sort of a sidur dum. We have a halacha, a misadvin lebal chov, that you can't take away all of a debtor's assets at once, that you have to make sure that they have enough left in order to subsist and so forth, and that could be a determination that should only really be made by Beis Din. So what we do is that only in cases where there's a complete confession of judgment, and the defendant says, I just don't want to, you know, go through the formality of the Beis Din proceeding, because the outcome is I owe the money, I'm just not paying it right now, but I have no real defenses. They just sign a confession of judgment and we allow the plaintiff to take that confession of judgment and to enforce it in a secular court if it's simply an enforcement action. But whenever there's any kind of defense whatsoever that the defendant can assert, so really, even more than a Midas Chasidus, it just makes sense for the case to be brought to Beis Din. But some argue that there are certain types of actions that even nowadays qualify as this chov borer type of case described by the Maharsham. One of the contemporary cases where this comes up from time to time is you have a school that wants to collect unpaid tuition from parents. They have, and they say there's an unambiguous tuition contract. You just haven't paid my tuition, and we want to go after we want to use a collection agency in order to be able to collect the tuition. The collection agency is going to ultimately use the court system. If after all of their threatening and intimidating telephone calls and letters, the parents still haven't paid tuition, so the next step is to go to court. So are they allowed to do that? So we have told schools that we feel, you never know, there might be some sort of a defense, a counterclaim that the parents might have, so it's appropriate in the first instance to go to Beis Din. But in the event that the case is brought directly to court, so arguably there would be the possible justification of saying this is a completely unambiguous obligation, this qualifies as a chov borer according to the Maharsham's criteria, and therefore that's more of a justification of using a collection agency, even though my own opinion is that it's appropriate, and this is, I think, our official policy, that it is appropriate in the first instance that one should bring even that type of a case to Beis Din, as well. Now, the other another application of when it would be appropriate to go to a secular court would be where there is a decision that was handed down by the Beis Din, as we mentioned earlier, and the party that's supposed to pay money is refusing to pay the money. So the poskim discuss, is the winning party, shall we say, wants to enforce the Bezdin's decision, are they allowed to go to secular court without getting permission of the Bezdin first? Or can they, or do they need to receive the permission of the Bezdin first? So Shlomo Kluger and the Maharshach and a number of different authorities came to the conclusion, the Maharsham came to the conclusion that it is permissible, even without getting the official permission of the Bezdin, to enforce a Bezdin permission in court. So the question arises, and they based it on a Rav Shri Ragon that's quoted by the Ramah. The way the Ramah quotes it, it's not 100% mukhbak one way or the other. But the question that arises is that the Ramah says that you're not allowed. Let's say that a party, it's the beginning, the initiation of the Bezdin, of the proceeding in front of the Bezdin, and a defendant is refusing to come to Bezdin. Is the plaintiff allowed to go to the civil court in order to compel the defendant, to come in front of the Bezdin? So the Ramah says, no, that would be a prohibition of Mesira. You're not allowed to do that. So how do you distinguish between these two different scenarios of using the secular court to compel the person to come in front of the Bezdin in the first place, which the Ramah says you shouldn't do, and enforcing the Bezdin decision, which we just indicated would be okay? So the Ben Sion Vosner, it was a dayan in Muncie. He's one of the sons of Shmuel Vosner Zatzal. So he writes an argument. He says, no, there's a big difference. Because when there already is a decision that was handed down by the Bezdin, so it's clear that you're not giving glory or respect to the secular court system because the parties already adjudicated the case in Bezdin. In that case, it's clear that the court is just serving as the enforcers of the Bezdin's decision, so therefore that is not any derogation of the respect for Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu or for the Bezdin system. But when they go to the civil court in the first instance before there was any Bezdin involvement, and they only get to Bezdin by dint and by virtue of the civil court order, so that is considered to be more of a glorification of the court system, and that's why the Ramah says that's not permitted. However, I would argue that nowadays, when most people would be going to the civil court, they'd be doing so with, say, like a shtar beruin, like, for example, a prenuptial agreement that they signed in a divorce case that said, if there's ever a dispute, we agree we're going to go to the Bezdin of America, we're going to go to the Bezdin of the Chicago Rabbinical Council. So the respect has already been accorded through the shtar beruin itself, through the arbitration agreement, the respect has already been accorded to the Bezdin. And when parties bring that agreement to the civil court, in order to get the civil court to compel the other party to appear before the Bezdin, it really wouldn't be a disrespect to the Bezdin. Probably would be okay. Also, the Ramah's concern was that it was more an issue of Mesira. If you hold like the Aruch HaShulchan, that you don't have to worry as much about Mesira nowadays, so you probably don't have to worry about that. And the Maisa, what ends up happening is that the Bezdin builds in, usually into the language of both its arbitration agreement and builds into its system that parties are allowed to utilize the civil courts, whether to enforce the arbitration agreement to appear before the Bezdin or whether to enforce the decision of the Bezdin at the end of the day. So it is now 2:30, so we will stop here. This is really just an overview, so you can understand some of the issues, some of the parameters, the seriousness of the prohibition of going to secular courts, the importance of having a viable Bezdin system, and all of the different types of nuances and scenarios where one might have a dispensation to go to a secular court. But ultimately, it has to all be under the rubric of giving respect and giving glory to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu and to the divine system of law that HaKadosh Baruch Hu enabled us to have. As we said this morning, and our Shir Shel Yom, Elokim Nitzav Adas Kev HaKerem HaKalim Mishpot, through the Dayanim, we're able to be Meshatev, you know, called Dayan Adon Dinemes Lamito, Kilo Naseh Shutov Im HaKadosh Baruch Hu Maiseh Bereishis, that we're able to really keep the world going to having a proper system of justice, and it's something that we should all respect and appreciate.